Hello everyone and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast. I hope everyone's kept safe and well over the past week and you've all been adapting to isolation life well. If you haven't, here's some tips from me. Number one, learn to cook and use what you have. Cooking a meal is very rewarding and it gives you a great sense of accomplishment at the end. Number two, if you can, go outside or just be in your garden. Try not to focus on anything else around you other than being outside. Look at the plants, listen to the birds and enjoy it. And finally, number three, check in with your friends. You need them and they will really need you. I hope those three things work for you in the same way they're currently working for me. Now, away from COVID-19 and onto today's very exciting show. On today's episode, I had the absolute pleasure of chatting with BBC Wildlife presenter, explorer and naturalist Steve Backshaw. It was lovely to hear Steve speak about his love for wildlife, specifically sharks, and also hear his pride in today's generation on what they're doing to save the planet. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us on iTunes or Podbean. Leave us a comment or a review and share the show with your friends. Stay safe, keep well, and enjoy the show. Hi Steve, thanks so much for joining me on this episode. How's life at the moment in the crazy time?
It's odd. It's decidedly strange, as I'm sure it is for every single one of your listeners.
Yeah, it's I think it's the uncertainty at the moment. I think that's what everyone's going through. Just the no idea. You know, once normal life's been obstructed, that's kind of the everything else gets interrupted as well, doesn't it? So
it's so unprecedented, isn't it? You know, anything that has happened in the past that's affected our country, I mean, the closest thing I can think to it is when that Icelandic volcano erupted.
Absolutely,
all of the flights were cancelled, and the skies were clear and there was a kind of eerie quiet around, and that seemed weird enough, but you compare that to now and it's just different stratospheres, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I think not knowing what's going to happen next, not knowing how long it's going to run on for, it's really tricky trying to plan your strategy.
Yeah, and the fact that it's global, I think this is what's really getting to me at the moment, is that you're looking at it going, this isn't just the UK or Europe, this is the entire planet at the moment has kind of been drawn to a halt.
So a live homeschool on Wednesday morning, and I was having people who were kind of like keying in from Tasmania and New Zealand and Australia, and hearing that they are going through the exact same things that we are, and their uncertainty as to what happens next, it puts it all into perspective.
Absolutely, yeah, it really does. So I really appreciate, because I saw you were doing a lot of homeschooling stuff, which is fantastic at the moment. And I know I've got friends, kids that are watching these at the moment for you. So I won't keep too much of your time, but I wanted to, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a big fan of your work and everything you've been involved in. And the first question I'm going to ask you, you've probably been asked thousands of times before, so you've probably got an answer straight away. But in regards to the natural world and wildlife, what was it that what was it that kind of drew you in at the beginning? Was this from a kid that you had this kind of love for the natural world?
Yeah, very much so. So my parents tell stories of me as a sort of 2 and 3 year old going through the compost heap and looking for grass snakes and coming back in with worms hanging out my mouth. And I'm sure that corresponds to a love for the natural world, but there was no question that I was happiest when I was outside. I was happiest when I was grimy and covered in mud, and I always had an inbuilt love for nature.
Yeah,
but I'm not convinced that is something that necessarily is unique or unusual to me. I mean, I look at my new young toddler now, Logan, and he's happiest when he's doing that kind of stuff, but he's being put in those situations by Helen and I, and I kind of wonder if to a certain extent we're all born with that same fascination for the outside world. It's just whether it gets nurtured or not, and for me it was. I was lucky enough to have parents who were crazy keen on the outdoors and on travel. We grew up on a small farm, and for me it was very, very natural to be surrounded by animals all the time and to basically be booted out of the house at the beginning of the day and come back when I was cold and tired and hungry, and that actually sounds a bit like abuse when I say it like that, but that's kind of what my childhood was like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I share that same thing with you as well, because it is, and especially I had that comparison with my brother, because my brother, whilst is into the natural world, not to the extent that I am, and it was the fact, I remember my mum talking to her friends going, Lee would be outside playing football and go, Ryan's in the garden collecting bugs, as if there was a problem with it at some point. Like, it was always, it was considered, I think, for me sometimes a bit, not abnormal, I won't use that, but it was like, it wasn't the normal thing for kids of my age to be doing. Because I grew up in quite suburb areas where, you know, you could, there's loads of kids everywhere, there's footballs, bikes and stuff. So it was quite weird, but I like the fact that you said that about, as long as we have, you have that instinct, but if it's nurtured, it comes out more. I think I agree with that as well. Do you find nature as something you must have around you now as well? Or is it something you kind of always need around you to keep like a healthy mindset and stuff?
Yeah, it is. And I think that I'm very lucky in that I learned quite early on in my life what it was that made me happy. And I was also quite lucky in finding out the thing that I always had up my sleeve when I got blue. You know, I kind of know that if there's ever a down time in my life, that I'm going to make myself better by going out and going for a walk, by going out and climbing a mountain, by going up and going for a kayak. And it's a weapon that I've always had in my armory, which I guess to a certain extent is being taken away now. And I think that, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who feel the same way that I do, that are going to struggle. They're going to really struggle over the next few months because, you know, that very natural way of living is going to become impossible for them.
Yeah, it's a shock to a lot of people's systems, I think. It's I run a dog daycare company myself, and we've ceased trading a couple of days ago, and it's that going from walking, you know, 18 kilometers a day to now doing the bare minimum just for exercise is a real shock to the physical and mental system of my body, definitely.
So what's happening to the dogs?
Well, this is the thing. It was a tough call for us to make. It was just getting unsafe to the point of we had a few key workers, but the parks were just too busy in London. A lot of parks were taking away the bins because the incinerators locally were being closed down for the time being. And it was getting impractical for us to be able to do our job. And obviously, I've got a team to kind of ensure that I'm safe, my customer base. I also live with an NHS doctor who's having to isolate at the moment, so I have to take these kind of things into consideration. It was really hard.
Well, mate, I feel for you. It's it's certainly tricky times. And you know, I'm lucky in that we live by the river. We have a small garden. It's not a big garden, but it's an open space that we can go into.
Yeah.
And I think with three very young kids, if we didn't have that, it would be so hard right now.
Really?
And my heart just goes out to all those people. I've been seeing on the news today, people who live in Tower Hamlets and, you know, have just had their one local park closed down to them.
Oh, God.
And you just think it must feel like being in prison. I really feel so, so bad for them.
Yeah, it's the same. And I mean, we're lucky where I live in London. I've got a garden, you know, it's a London garden, very patioed, but it's still outdoor space where we can sit in the sun and kind of be out and about. I do feel for the people in other means of London accommodation that is not suited, especially not suited for the current climate. But I was going to ask you about one of your loves for animals as well, because you're a big fan of sharks, aren't you?
I am. I would say that sharks are probably my obsession more than any other kind of animal. It's just something that I ever since a young age, I think originally it fascinated me because sharks are seen to be this big, terrifying predator that is all dominant in its world. And then the further I went on through life, the more it was the exact opposite that entranced me. It was the fact that there's so much mythology about sharks. There's so many legends about them and the way that they behave that are simply not true. And it became more a fascination with both their biology and their evolution, but also their future and the fact that more than perhaps any other group of animals, they are very much teetering on the brink of extinction.
Yeah.
And all of it came together to form a complex picture of an animal or a group of animals that just fascinates me and frightens me in equal measure, but not the kind of fear that you might expect. It's definitely not fear that every time I'm swimming with one, they're gonna eat me. It's the fear that my kids might not have the opportunities that I have had to swim alongside them.
That's amazing. What a wonderful way to look at it. Yeah, I agree with that, because I've always, I share that love with you. Sharks are in one of my top couple of animals. And I always put it down to that kind of fear of something, but I think it's more an awareness of the power of the animal that I love more than the fear of the animal itself.
Yeah, I would go along with that. I mean, I think that having done over 1,000 dives now with different kinds of sharks, everything from, you know, tiny little cat sharks right up to great whites outside of the cage, and I've started to learn their body language, their personal space, the times when it can be, you know, incredibly safe to dive alongside a shark, you know, safer than it can be to dive along some kinds of seals or dolphins.
Yeah.
And other times when you don't make that call, and other times where you have to be more sensible and respectful. And it's a much more complex situation encountering a shark underwater than you might first think.
So what's the closest you've got to one of the large species of shark? Have you been free water diving with them? With the large species?
I've dived open water with great whites.
Wow.
I've probably done like 9 or 10 days worth of that, maybe 4 or 5 dives a day.
That's incredible.
And never at any stage felt in any danger. But the flip side of that would be that I've probably done, I would guess, a couple of hundred hours underwater with tiger sharks.
Mm.
And again, never really felt in any danger, except for one specific occasion when we went down at dusk, when tiger sharks are at their most active.
Yeah.
And we lasted in the water for no more than about 4 or 5 minutes before we were all out and shaking like a leaf, because the behavior of the animal was just totally different in low light, in more turbid water, with lower visibility, when the animals are at their kind of predatory most heightened state. It was a totally different experience, one that we all very quickly realized was not safe.
Yeah, that must have been some adrenaline rushing through your body with that.
Yeah, and not the right kind of adrenaline.
Absolutely not. God, I'm not comfortable in the water at the best of times, so that scenario would not have been good for Ryan. We're talking about diving with the sharks. You've gone on so many epic adventures in your career. You've done, like you said earlier, mountain summits. You've done epic canoe journeys as well, which I was so surprised. And you've completed a marathon in 2005 that I just want to get your quick experience of, because it's one that I found out of at quite a young age, and I've been into long distance running myself, and it's always one that I've gone, oh, maybe one day, was the one in the Sahara Desert. What was that?
The Marathon des Sables.
Yes, that's it. How was that? What was that experience like?
Do you know what? It was actually one of the most life-affirming and fun experiences I've ever had.
Wow.
I think I was at the time very well prepared for it. I trained really well. I prepared really well. The people that weren't prepared for it had a life-changing experience of a totally different kind, because they went through the kind of pain that I would not wish on my worst enemy.
Wow.
But for those that were in good shape and were prepared for it, you know, we had 160 miles of running through some of the most stunning scenery you can possibly imagine, alongside 600 other people, all of whom were complete nutters of the best possible kind.
Yeah.
You know, I have some of my very best friends now that are still from that one race.
There's
still
that's amazing.
People that I encountered back then and were such extraordinary human beings that I've stayed in touch with them, and they remain some of my most treasured friends.
Yeah.
I think there's a very particular kind of eccentricity that you need to have to want to go and run 160 miles across the Sahara.
To even consider it, yeah. Yeah, it must be an amazing thing. How do you start with training with that?
Well, I started with a lot of mountain marathons. So I've been doing a lot of fell running. I've been doing a lot of running in the hills. I didn't do any training for heat, because you kind of can't. You sort of you know, have to acclimatize as and when while you're there. And you're not running fast. There's not many people who do really run fast. I think my fastest marathon was 4 hours 20. So
okay.
You know, it's not like, you know, super quick running, unless you're one of the top 10 finishers. You take your time, you make sure you get on board plenty of water, and you kind of enjoy it and enjoy the company of all the people you're with. I had a blast
That's amazing. What a great takeaway from it as well. That's an amazing. I'd near say you've tempted me to do it, but maybe not too soon. Let's. I want to ask you as well a bit. Obviously, away from the current kind of epidemic that we're going through, or pandemic rather. When we look at the natural world, it's no secret in the last 5 years, it's not been a secret for a while, but I think it's been in mainstream media a lot more that the natural world is being pushed to its absolute limits at the moment. For you, what would you say is the biggest challenge that we face right now in regards to the natural world?
It has so many different elements, most of which come down to the fact that there are too many of us and we are consuming too much. And the enormous gulf between the wealthy of us, the wealthiest of us, and the poorest is absurd and obscene. And you know, that wealthiest 1% of the population are consuming an amount that is beyond insanity.
Yeah.
And then there's probably another 10% of whom I probably would have to consider myself one, who are still taking more than their share. And we have to find some way of rationalizing that. We have to find some way of, you know, getting rid of our single-use culture, because the amount of garbage and single-use plastic trash that we're creating, it is totally unsustainable.
Absolutely.
And that is something that has ramped up in the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, I would say that before that, if I went to a deserted beach in the back end of nowhere, you'd see a few bits of flotsam and jetsam that would wash up on the beach. Now you do it and it looks like a rubbish tip.
Wow, so is that soon it's got that bad in the last 5 years?
It has got that bad in the last 5 years.
Wow.
So obviously I've been traveling for a living since the early 1990s. And I have seen the slow change of how we humans are affecting the planet. It's been slow until the last 5 years, and then all of a sudden everything has just gone nuts.
Wow.
And you know, it is at a level. I thought when I first started traveling for a living in the 1990s, I thought that we were wrecking the planet and it was as bad as it could get, but I had no clue. You know, the speed to which things have picked up over the last 5 years is truly terrifying. But the flip side of that is that in the last 2 years there is a whole wave of activism from young people that has sprung up of a level that I've never seen before. Young people who are more erudite, educated, passionate, ambitious, resourceful, and completely committed to their cause than has ever existed before. I say this over and over again, but I believe that this time in history is going to be looked back at in the future alongside the great civil rights movements of the past. People are going to look back on now as the time when young people woke up to the problems of the environment and made them their own. And I think it's humbling. It is truly humbling. You know, I've never met Greta, but I've met at least 100 of her peers.
Yeah.
All of them intimidate the hell out of me. What on earth have I been doing with my life? Because they're so switched on, they're so intelligent, they have all the right words, they're utterly media savvy, they know how to use modern technology, and they are making big changes. You know, I've spoken alongside them in Parliament. I've spoken at gatherings of thousands of people where I, as a, you know, broadcaster of 20 years, have been absolutely wetting myself, and they just stride out onto the stage and speak as if they've been doing it for decades. It kind of makes me feel like I've wasted my life, to be honest.
Well, but my last question to you was going to be if you could pass on some advice to the generation of today, what would it be? But it sounds like it might be the other way around.
They don't need my advice.
They sound like they've got it pretty much fixed and everything. That's great to hear.
What would I say? No, I would pass on advice. My first bit of advice would be treasure the natural world as much as you possibly can. It can give us so much. It is a panacea for so much of our ills. It is a cure for you when you're in a dark place.
Yeah.
It is a source of endless wonder, a kind of spark to any imagination. Learn as much as you can about it and find out the ways that you can take care of it and you can protect it, because we are relying on you.
Wonderful. And my last question, outside of the current COVID-19, what's next for you, Steve? What have you got in the pipelines? Or is it unknown at the moment?
I had a whole list of expeditions lined up that I was about to be starting and going away on right now. Obviously, they've all been postponed. Who knows? Who knows? It's completely up in the air. I mean, I've started writing a book, a fiction novel at home to try and find a way of paying my mortgage. But beyond that, honestly, my guess is as good as yours.
I guess that's the situation we all find ourselves in at the moment, isn't it?
It really is. It really is.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for taking this time to chat to me. I really appreciate it.
And not at all. It's a pleasure speaking to you.
You too. Keep safe over the next couple of weeks.
I will. All the very best.
Take care.